Tonight is Wednesday, December 19th, or 7th day of Tevet. This is the Women's Mishnah Shiur. We're up to the first parak of Bava Kamma. Okay, Rabotai, we start a new Mishnah tonight. The last time we studied Maseches Bava Kamma 2 weeks ago, we had cited a debate about the nature of the payment of a keren, of an ox that gores for the first three times. The first three times it's called a tam. It is considered somewhat unusual that the animal engages in this type of behavior. And there were two ways to look at the 50% payment. One way was to say, you know what, you should have paid for the full damage. But because it's so difficult to watch an ox, the Chachamim or the Torah has compassion upon you and says, you know what, first three times we'll let you off the hook, only 50%. In which case, the nature of the payment of the 50% is what's called mamon. It's what you really owe the person. Because by right, you owe them 100%. So the 50% is real damages based on what you are responsible for, what you are, what you triggered. You were responsible by the fact that you were lacking in your ability to watch your animal. But since it's so difficult, the Torah said, we'll be nice to you, you pay only 50%. The second opinion was that no, it is considered so unreasonable to expect you, to anticipate that your animal's going to go ahead with anger and intend to damage, that the first three times you should have paid nothing. No compensation whatsoever. Because it's something unreasonable for us to anticipate and expect. The 50% that the Torah demands that you do pay should be perceived as a fine. A fine is always defined as a payment in excess of what you're technically obligated to observe, to pay. That's the definition of a knas, a fine. So, if I were to break into your house tonight, because you are here, and I don't have to confront you, and I steal something, that will make me a ganav. A ganav. If I take out my gun right now and I say, give me your cash, I am a gazlan. If I am caught in the first case, I pay double, kefel. If the police catch me after I broke into your house and I did not confront you, that's one of the definitions of a ganav, I'm afraid to confront my victim, and I am subsequently caught, I pay double. But if I am not afraid of you, and I come up to you and I say, give me your money or I'm going to blow you away, and you give me your money, and then I'm caught, I only pay what I stole. I don't pay a fine. So with a ganav, let's say I stole $100, the first $100 is mamon. That's what I owe you, because that was the value of what I stole. The second $100 is a fine. So last time we learned one halacha that impacts whether the nature of the payment is a fine or the nature of the payment is money that is owed. What was that one halacha? What was the case? Where you modeh biknas. What does modeh biknas mean? I came to Beit Din before the witnesses showed up. I came and acknowledged my wrongdoing. So the halacha is, whenever I do something and the Torah expects me to pay for the damage or that which I stole, then the fact that you admitted it is not going to get you off the hook completely. So if I went into your house and stole this tape recorder, it's worth $100, and I come to Bet Din and I say, you know what? I stole the tape recorder. Bet Din will say, you paid $100, baby, but you don't have to pay the fine of the second $100. Because somebody who acknowledges their wrongdoing, Beis Din exempts you from the fine. It's a way of encouraging people to admit their guilt. How? By telling you. If you come forward, your punishment will be reduced. We all do that in any situation. You tell your kids, if you come forward, it's going to be the consequences are not going to be as severe. Fine. So if the nature of Chatzi Nezek, as we pointed out, if I should have paid 100, because that's what I should have paid, and the Torah is nice and said I only pay 50, and so when I come running to Beis Din before any witnesses, and I say, hey, Mr. Beis Din, my ox gored and was responsible for this damage, you pay for it. Because your admission triggers a responsibility to pay for that which you damaged, for that which you stole. But if the nature of the 50% payment was that by right I shouldn't pay at all, because the Torah says it's much too difficult for the first three times to expect you to watch it. How do I look at the 50% payment? It's a fine. So now if I come to Beit Din and I say, listen, Dayanim, my ox gored this person and caused this damage, I don't pay a penny. Why? Because I acknowledged my responsibility, and as a result, I am not going to be held accountable for the payment of fines if Beit Din becomes aware of it through my own admission. That was consequence number one. Tonight, before we start the next Mishnah, we are going to see consequence number two and number three. Yes? So if the nature of the 50% payment which the Torah demands is perceived conceptually as nothing but a fine, that means by right, how much should you have paid the first three times? Nothing. And the Torah imposes a fine. Well, if the nature of the payment is a fine, and you come forward and acknowledge your wrongdoing, Beit Din says, we waive the fine. So you won't pay anything. That's correct. As an incentive to what? To do what you're supposed to do. Tonight we're going to see consequences two and number three. The first, consequence number two is on the top of page number one, in the middle of the first line.
Sorry.
Don't be sorry. In the middle of the first line. The law Magbinon Bebavel. We cannot collect the fine in Babylonia. The law Magbinon Bebavel. Any fine cannot be collected in Babylonia. Can't. On the top of the first.
What is that? This is not the former Mishnah. What is that?
This is in the middle of the previous Gemara. It's in the middle of the previous Gemara. It's irrelevant.
Yeah, okay.
I'm only here to focus on what's relevant. As you know, we don't do it straight, right? We're skipping around. Because otherwise we'll still be on Daf Beis Amud Aleph in the first mission in the first five lines. So so number two, the lo magbinon bebavel. If, I'm going to explain why. If this ox, if I lived in Teaneck or Babylonia, and my ox gored your ox and caused $100 worth of damage, if the nature of payment is that of mamon, meaning I should have paid you 100 because that's my damage, but the Torah was nice and reduced to 50, then it will be collected in Bavel or in Teaneck. But if the nature of the payment was a fine, because by right, I should not have paid a nickel. And now the Torah imposes a fine. No fines are collected in Bavel. I'll explain why in a second.
Is that exclusive to Bavel?
No. No fines are collected in Chutz La'aretz.
Oh.
No fines. And the reason being is because in order to collect and assess a fine, the Bet Din who adjudicates the case must have smicha. The Dayanim must have legitimate smicha. And the only definition of having legitimate smicha is to get smicha from somebody who got smicha from Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe granted smicha to 71 people at his time. The Torah tells us this. He granted the first Sanhedrin to 70 people. When they got older, or one retired, went to Florida, what happens? The Bet Din granted smicha to somebody else. So as long as there is an operative Sanhedrin, it is possible to replenish the system, and such was the case from the beginning of time immemorial, from the time that Moshe did this at 1 year after the Exodus from Egypt, so it's approximately 3,300 years ago, until the year 200 of the Common Era. However, when the Romans took control over Israel and destroyed the second Beit HaMikdash, the Romans, after a while, were out to eliminate Yahadut as a bona fide practicing religion. One of the things that they tried, lots of things, which they identified over various years to decide, if you eliminate this, Jews disappear. So for example, at one time in Roman history, they legislated, you're not permitted to recite the Shema during davening. You recite the Shema, you're shot on the spot. So they posted guards in the middle of the shul, and they saw when the liturgy was up to Shema, anybody would say, Shema Yisrael, you shoot him, and that's it. So what did the rabbis say? Okay, we're skipping the Shema. We're not going to say it. I'm not going to risk my life to say the Shema. So they were a little smarter than them. What did they do? They snuck in Shema in the Kedusha of Musaf. Why does Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad appear in the Kedusha of Musaf? Because the guards, they noticed, after Shachris, went home. We accomplished our objective. Now they're reading the Torah, they're davening Musaf. So, we duped them. They recited just the Pasuk of Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad is there. Because according to many authorities, the Ramban is Berosham, all you need is the first Pasuk to fulfill your biblical requirement of the Shema. The rest is gravy. But Midoraita, says the Ramban, only the first Pasuk. So we somehow snuck it in order to what? To circumvent the Roman decree. There was another time in Roman history where they said, nobody is permitted to recite the Amidah, Shmon Esrei. Not allowed to. So, if you're familiar with the weekday Maariv service, after the Bracha of Hashkibenu, Shomer Amo Yisrael Lo'an, there is a paragraph called Baruch Hashem Le'olam Amein V'Amein. If you look at it, the phrase Baruch appears 18 times in that paragraph. That paragraph is not mandated, doesn't appear in the Talmud text. The others are mentioned. Hashkivenu, Hama'ariv Aravim, they may talk about those. That bracha doesn't exist. What did they do? They created a tefillah which would be recited seated, which mimicked the essence of the Shmoneh Esrei, and the Roman guards were standing there, and they thought they accomplished their objective. No Amidah, nobody's standing for Shmoneh Esrei, so we duped them again. One time in Jewish history, they said, no public Torah study. No public Torah study. So who was crucified based on the fact that he violated that edict? Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was martyred because he challenged them and he studied Torah in public. Well, one time they said, anybody who grants smicha to a student will be executed on the spot. So all of the smicha students Smicha as an institution had to go underground. And apparently they did a very effective job of eliminating it. The Gemara tells us, he's one of the Asara Haruge Malchut. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was the last person to grant Smicha. The conditions were almost impossible to do. He went up onto a mountain in which there was only a one-way road, only one lane at a time. He stood there on one side of the mountain, on top of the mountain, and five students were on the other side. Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Gamliel, and Rabbi Akiva. And the other side were the Romans pursuing him. And they shot at him, but he granted smicha to those five. After that, the institution of smicha disappeared. So if the institution of smicha disappeared, there is no way to what? To perpetuate certain aspects of the Sanhedrin. In Bavel, even during the time when they did grant smicha in Israel, you're not allowed to grant smicha in Babylonia. Chutz Laaretz, you cannot grant smicha. Can only grant smicha in Eretz Yisrael. So for certain types of cases, for example, capital punishment cases, somebody turns on the light on Shabbos, two witnesses witness it, and they say, Reb Yid, or Rebetzin Yid, if you're going to turn on the light on Shabbos, you're going to violate the law, and the penalty is stoning. Don't do that. And he says, I'm doing it nonetheless. You cart him off the bez, and they stone him the next day. Or that very day. That punishment, capital offenses, can only be handled in a bet din of smuchin. So there was never any capital execution cases handled in Babylonia. So number one, part of the jurisdiction limited to a samuch is that you cannot collect fines. Only a bet din that has the jurisdiction or the license of a samuch can collect fines. So today, Rabotai, even in Eretz Yisrael, we don't collect these fines. Why? Because there are no smuchim left. There are no smuchim left. Because the last person who received smicha from someone who received smicha was Rabbi Meir. And he's dead almost 2,000 years. So there's nothing we can do about it. In fact, Rambam, recognized the problem. How are we ever going to revive the Sanhedrin again? And have smicha. If you need smicha from someone who got smicha, and they're dead for 1800 years, you mean the rest of our life we're never going to have smicha again? So the Rambam did what he does quite a number of times, does not frequently, and he says, I'm going to say something and I have no source for it. Yera'eli, it appears to me, Moshe ben Maimon, that there is a way to do it. You poll all of the Talmidei Chachamim in Eretz Yisrael and you ask them, can you come to an agreement that one person is a samach? Can you come to an agreement that one person is a samach? If they agree that such is the case, that person halachically is a samach and he then grants smicha to 70 others and now we have a Sanhedrin. It's that simple. Of course, it's not that simple. Because it was tried three times in Jewish history. In the 1500s, that's correct. The proposal was to make Rabbi Yosef Karo, the author of Shulchan Aruch, the Samach. He was undoubtedly the greatest Talmudic scholar of his time. He was a Kabbalist as well. So he had everything. And it was almost going to happen at the very last minute, the Yerushalmi rabbis said, we're withdrawing him as our candidate. Why? Because he lives in Tzfat. The Samuch is not going to come from Yerushalayim Ir HaKadosh? What, are you ripped? And they didn't, that was it. So in the 1500s, that was it. It died for 250 years. In the 1750s, they tried someone else. His name was Rabbi Yaakov Ben Yakar. He didn't get the mustard either. In 1950, Rav Maimon, who was one of the signatories of the Declaration of Independence of Medinat Yisrael, suggested that we recreate the Sanhedrin. And he probably would have had to say, maybe the Chazon Ish, the Brisker Rav, or somebody should be the one. But they could not come to a unanimous agreement, and that's why there is no Sanhedrin. But if there was a Sanhedrin, like I said, every major issue would be resolved instantly. Instantly. So one of the differences, any fine cannot be handled without a summer. So, when I go into your house, ladies, and I take this tape recorder, and it's worth $100, Besdin, there's a local civil court here, right? How much will I have to pay? Only $100. I'm not going to have to pay the fine of $200, the extra $100. Why? Because a Besdin that is not a samuch has no capacity to handle dinei knasot. That's the halacha. There are no exceptions to the rule. No exceptions to. They're allowed to handle regular cases, not fines, because otherwise, all hell will break loose. If there is no court system, anybody, I can go ahead and steal, and there's no recourse for you. So we have to have some type of civil court, just to make sure that there's peace and tranquility, law and order. But fines, that you cannot do. That's consequence number two. Whether the nature of a payment is mamon, or the nature of the payment is a fine. So now we're going even to chatzi nezek. The 50% payment of an ox that gores for the first three times. If the nature of the payment is mamon, you can claim it in bet din today. If the nature of the payment is a knas, sorry buddy, you're out. The damage, you cannot recover your money at all. Doesn't seem fair. Tough darts. Those are the rules and regulations. Halachic consequence number three is, it's the last three words of the second line on that page. Ve'i tofas lo mafkinan mine. I tofas. What does tofas mean? I grabbed it. What does this mean? I am in Bavel. I'm in Bavel. And I know that Besdin is not going to be able to adjudicate this case. So I took the law into my own hands. What did I do? My ox gored your ox. And the nature of the payment on that assumption is that it's a fine. I should pay you nothing. I go into your house. And I took a television. I took a whole set of Rambams. I just walked into the house and took something. And when you come after me, you'll take me to Besdin, whatever local court there is, and the Besdin will ask you, Rabbi Adler, why did you take that set of Rambams from this guy's house? Because his ox gored my ox, and I know I have no other recourse. If the person took it, Besdin will not extract it. Even though you're not supposed to rule as such in court, but if you decided to become a vigilante and what? Take control of the matter yourself and extract. Tofas means to grab something. Lo mafkina mine. We do not excise, we do not remove that which you took from that individual. You do not remove it from that individual. Now, let's assume the damage which my ox was responsible was $150, and the set of Rambam that I took for you was worth $5,000. So now, turn the page for a second. Turn the page for a second. Don't turn the page. Look at the Tosafot, right under the number one. Right under the number one. Says Tosafot, Omer Rabbeinu Tam. Number one, there are certain rules and regulations. Dafka only itafas hamazik atzmo. I can't send a henchman. I can't send a thug to go into your house. Who has to do it? You, yourself. The victim has to go into your house and somehow seize some of your assets. Keep going. Kelev, you'll take a dog. Or Shunra, a cat of yours. Whatever it is. The lo mafkina. The reason why,
Dibimazik hekelu chachamim shiyuchal lahachzik bo im lakol b'shasa hezek. If, and there's another condition, says Tosfos, when do I have to do this? Not 5 years later. As soon as I find out that your ox was responsible for damages, right away I have to go to your house and take something out. Why? Why did the Chachamim allow me to do it? Because they don't want your animals to be running scot-free and damaging my property, and there's no recourse for you. So even though technically Beit Din cannot handle this case, the Chachamim said, I'm going to allow you to take the matter into your own hand. Now, Tosfos will also say, if for some reason I took something worth $5,000, the damage was $100, you can come to Beit Din and say, listen, Beit Din, I caused $150 of damage and he took something worth $5,000. Beit Din will force me to give the item back. And they will, Bezin will say, do you have anything worth $150? And if you say yes, that'll be fine. You'll give me the $150. If you have nothing besides that $5,000 Rambam, Beit Din will sell it and give you $4,850, and you'll keep the $150. You cannot seize in excess of the damage.
But you can seize.
But you can.
Well, it's just like, it's the same thing as a fine. I mean, it's just dancing around.
That's correct. What's happening here is as follows. As happens so frequently, the fine issue is defined by the Torah. You must have smicha. The rabbis, as they do so often, are going to circumvent the Torah. Because they know
it will lead to human nature. Will lead
it is a fine. If I'm assuming that it's a fine,
but it's not the fine that allegedly would be not permissible.
Right. Let's take the case where I stole your tape recorder, and it's worth. And what's the fine? $200. It's worth $100. If it was a best, then how much would you pay me if you were caught? You get fined $100. So now, if I took the $200, I took it. So, lo mafkino.
What you're taking is the value of the object.
No, the value of the object was 100. But a fine is you pay another 100.
So
if you would go to Besdin, Besdin would award you only $100. But the fine, you would not be entitled to. So I just took it, you just took it yourself.
You take what's equivalent to the fine.
Correct. In this case, with the damages, we're operating on the assumption that the Torah would have said you pay nothing. So the 50% is all identified as a fine. That's what I seized for you. 50% of the damage. It was $500 worth of damage. The Torah says now I pay $250. It's a fine. I grabbed something worth $250. Why? Because often the rabbis will do something when there is an economic need or a reason to somehow circumvent Torah law. I can give you 80,000 illustrations where that happens. 80,000. Yes.
Because
they didn't want it all hell to break loose. You're going to have all your uncles and you know what? If you, the injured party, feel that you have to do it, it's fine. Anybody who does it, it's theft. Anybody else who walks into your house, that's theft.
The person allows the person.
You can't
to
ignore.
No, he doesn't.
But
he doesn't allow it.
The problem is it's kind of like a vigilante thing, even with one person.
Right.
So they're setting themselves up for
Correct. No, he's not going to kill him. He kills him, he'll be held accountable for that. But when you decided to recline on your lawn chair on Pennington Avenue, and you went in to grab a soda, Pennington Road, so this guy will be scouting you. As soon as you get out, he grabs your chair. That's all. It's right out there. Go grab it. Why?
It's so vigilante. Vigilante justice.
It is.
Yeah.
Correct.
So then it's...
It is. In this particular case, it's vigilante justice. You're never allowed to murder anybody for juvenile... Never.
Not allowed to injure anybody for vigilante justice. You're never allowed to. Exactly. Excellent analogy. Excellent analogy. The halach of the Goel Hadam. Somebody, that's correct. Somebody is guilty of a murder.
It was accidental.
Hold on. That has to be determined by the court.
That would be vigilant.
Any time that somebody is murdered, whether you do it deliberately or accidentally, you have one place to go to. It's called Arei Miklat, the city of refuge. Now that you're there, Bezdin handles the case. Now let's see. Did you do it deliberately? They take you out of the Arei Miklat, and what do? They execute you. If they establish the fact that it was actually, you stay there until the Kohen Gadol dies. At most, a Kohen HaGadol. You stay there for the rest of your life. For the rest of your life. And in fact, if I'll have to go to the Arei Miklat, you're going to have to come with me. The Gemara says all of the Talmidim have to come with the Rebbe. All the Rebbe. No, the Rebbe doesn't have to go to Talmidim. If the Rebbe goes to Arei, the Talmidim come with him. Come with him. What? Everybody. Because they want you to keep you learning. That's why. You're not. What?
They're being punished.
No, it's an honor to come to the Arei Miklat city with your Rebbe. An honor. So no, it was only a murder by Shoge. It was an accidental murder. Accidental.
How large were these? You
we're all coming with you.
Right, that's correct. So now, here is the halacha. What happens if you decided you're not going to the Arei Miklat?
I mean, you decide you have no
choice. So the Torah says the closest kin, the closest relative, is allowed to kill you. He's allowed to kill you. If you don't go to, the only safe haven is an Arei Miklat. If you don't go to Arei Miklat, then the closest living relative is allowed to kill you. No questions asked.
Is that acknowledging that someone's desire to seek vengeance, and it's okay?
That's correct. It's here is an excellent illustration of where the Torah knows what you really want to do. I can't allow it under all cases. So if you don't follow our rules and regulations, I'm going to allow that person some liberty to do what they want.
So
and it's a very similar thing here.
You don't. Over your head.
That's correct. That's correct. And the same thing with the Knas. The Bezdin says, you know what? I'm going to let you go ahead and. The rabbi said, I'm going to let you go and take it. You better be careful with that ox. You better make sure you don't steal somebody's property. Because even you'll say, hey, there's no Bezdin, that's it, I'm going to get away with it, because there's nobody to prosecute. The rabbis say, we'll take care of it.
Wow.
We'll take care of it.
It's also saying that negligence is in a certain way somewhat of a crime.
Yes.
Whether it's murder or...
No doubt about it.
Be very careful.
No doubt about it. Right.
And it's very circumscribed too. It has to be
right. One of the greatest movies I ever saw. I remember, yes, it was called The Chamber. What happened? I don't remember who was in it, but here was the case. They had cases where every single time the guy got off on a technicality. So the judge, the DA, and the police chief would sit and deliberate the cases, and if they came to the conclusion that the person was guilty of sin, but he got off on a technicality, they hired a murderer, and they killed him. We don't want to have murderers running on the street. So one of the I'll never forget this example. This guy went ahead into somebody's house and shot him. Then, as he was running away, there was a garbage can there, and he threw the gun into the truck. And the police came and took the truck and took the gun out as evidence. His lawyer got him off the hook by saying it was an illegal search and they didn't have a warrant. That's correct. So here is what the judge ruled. Listen to this. But the judge ruled that if the garbage is still on the bottom before it goes, it's still the person's personal garbage. You need a search warrant for it. Once it goes up into the truck, into the with all the other garbage, that's considered, you know, communal property. You don't need a search warrant for that. So he got off on a technicality. 5 days later, he was dead. And they had various cases, similar profiles. And the movie ends where they executed an innocent person. He got off on a technicality, and he was actually innocent. But they thought he was guilty, and they wound up hiring a hitman to kill an innocent man. That's how the movie leaves you. It's a very powerful movie. So yes, Beis Din here has authorized that. Take the law into your own hands. Occasionally, if you follow the guidelines. Follow the guidelines. Yeah.
Two questions. First of all, what is the nature of ox? I mean, I don't have any idea.
Like, an ox?
An ox who gore? Do ox gore? I mean, do we have any? So is it normal for them to gore? And how are you supposed to stop them from goring?
You have to lock them up. It's talking about your property. You have to have them on the lock and key, put them in a corral which they can't get out. Now, since it is possible that it was so unusual, that's why it's only 50% according to one opinion. It's so bizarre, such strange, that we could not have anticipated. But if it happens three times, you see a pattern is developed, you better anticipate it.
So how can you not anticipate if you just said they're wild animals?
Who said he's a wild animal?
But didn't you say that you have to lock them up because they're...
Because if they went ahead... according to which
like
side of the coin?
Yeah, like a bull.
Mm-hmm. Like a bull. Yeah, I have a bull.
If it rains, they're going
to
go.
Right?
I don't understand why it has to wait three times. If it happens once, the owner should be...
Because the toll... Okay, so you can ask me why. Why do you have to wait the three times to pay the full damage? Because the Torah operates on the assumption that this is very difficult, and until an animal establishes a pattern, you can assume... He's not operating. You could not have anticipated. You don't have to anticipate it. Patterns, according to Jewish law, we're going to get to that a little later, are established by three times happening at the three consecutive times. That's when all patterns are established according to Jewish law. We're going to talk about it in great detail.
And also, is this just an ox, or is there some way that you can apply it? Like, if any animal?
Any animal.
Any of your
an ox. That's we're going to have this in this Mishnah. If we ever get to it.
Would that be a child also?
No. A child is a human being. A human being is something else. Something else. I mentioned to you, we'll get to it in the eighth para, if your child causes damage, the person who he damages is a tough luck. Nobody pays for it. Nobody pays for it. We'll get to that mission in the eighth para. A child that causes damage, parents are exempt from compensation. I don't quite understand that halacha, but that's... Right, you're responsible for your ox, but not for your child. That's correct. Yeah. So, this is the third consequence. Third consequence. So, tomorrow, when you are in Glad Express, and you're standing online, somebody taps you on the shoulder and says, what are the three consequences of something being defined as a knas, as opposed to mamon? Here they are. If you admit it, modeh b'knas. If you admit it, you come to Beis Din, you're exempt. Two, if it's in Chutz La'aretz, you can never collect it. Never collect it. It has to be at a time when there was a regular Beit Din with real smicha. Number three, if you decided to act independently and seize assets, you can do so, provide that you yourself do it. And it's the same thing by the Goel Adam, which Nechama said. If I have a relative of mine who was killed, I can't hire a hitman. If you don't go to the Arei Miklat, I can't hire a hitman to kill you. A professional hitman. You got to do it yourself. I have to buy the gun. Today is very easy. Buy the gun and go shoot. That's it. I got to do it myself. Myself. Yeah. Those are the three consequences of being a knas versus mamon, a monetary payment. Okay, now let's move to the Mishnah, which is staring you in the face. Now, actually, one second. Actually, you know, I want to read the last three lines of that Gemara, a very powerful statement of Rabbi Nassan. Rabbi Nassan Omer, Minayin shelo yigadel adam kelev ra betoch beito. How do I know that you're not allowed to have a pit bull in your house? How do I know?
It's the same thing.
But how do I know that you're not allowed to have it? Va'al ya'amid sulam ra'ua betoch beito. And don't have a defective ladder in your house. Talmud lomar, how do I know? Lo tasim damin bebeitecha. Don't place anything in your house that might be responsible for the loss of blood. The text is talking about if you have a house with a roof that was flat and serviceable, usable, as all houses in the time of the Mishnah were. Today, there are no houses, at least in our neighborhood, where the houses are flat. They're all pointed edge, so the water can run off. But if you have a house which is a flat roof and is usable, what must you erect around the perimeters? A fence. Well, if you don't put in a fence, you might be responsible for loss of life. And the Torah says, lo tasim damim bebeitecha. Don't create a situation whereby you will be responsible for loss of life. Don't. So, it doesn't only mean not to put up a fence on a roof. Having a wilde dog, a wild dog, in your house is also lo tasim bevesecha. Having a ladder that is a faulty ladder, let's assume you have a silo and the guy has to go climb up there, whatever it is, and it's not a good ladder, and you put it there and he climbs up, you're responsible to some extent. Same thing. If you have animals that you can't control, you're not allowed to own them. Not allowed to own them. Because they are prone to cause loss of life. Prone to cause loss of life. Doesn't mean that I will be held accountable for murder, because I didn't murder you. But I'll be held, there'll be other ramifications. Other ramifications. Good. Now let's see the Mishnah. Chamisha tamin v'chamisha muadin. The word tam refers specifically to an ox that gores the first three times. A tam. That's what it's called, a tam. A mu'ad is something which is habitual. Habitual. Where it's going to happen. Where it's expected to happen because this is already the pattern. So the Mishnah will enumerate five different cases where an ox will halachically be considered a tam until he does it till the fourth time. V'chamisha mu'adin. And five cases which halachically will be considered a mu'ad even the very first time. Very first time. Says the Mishnah. Ha behema eina mu'edet lo ligach. An animal is not considered as its regular behavior does not include that it gores with its horn. The Torah believes that most ox are calm fellows. That under ordinary circumstances, if you don't get them enraged, just walking around, they see somebody, they will not necessarily make a move at them. That's ligach. So the first time, you don't have to pay the full damage, only 50. Second time, third time, only 50%. On the fourth time that it happens, it's already a pattern, you pay full damage. Velo ligof. Mazel ligof. What does that mean? Right, to push you with its body. It didn't use its horns, but it saw you and pushed you against the wall and you broke your leg. Crushed your pelvis. Crushed your ribs. That's not typical animal behavior. So here we have Mishnayot, who people who studied animals. That's how they came to this conclusion. They studied animals. And their pattern of behavior was witnessed and observed. So that's number two.
Is this a way of holding the victim partly responsible?
Absolutely not.
It's not?
No. The victim was minding his own business, walking in the street. and this animal came running, came charging at me. Number three, lowly shoch, nishicha means to what? To bite. Animals are not biters by patterns of behavior. So when it bites, that's considered mishune. Maza mishune? Different. Unusual behavior. And therefore you only pay 50%. Unusual. Below lirbots. Lirbot means to lie on you. You're standing there, and Ergetz Schluffen, he just lies down on top of you. That's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. The low live out beitah is to kick you with its leg. Animals, when they're walking, don't kick people. Don't kick people. They don't kick other cows. So this is their experience. This is their experience. We have evidence in the Talmud of Amoraic sages spending 18 months on a farm to learn various aspects of animals. There is a halacha, for example, that when your animal gives birth to its firstborn, what happens to that animal? It's a bechor. What do you do with an animal that is a bechor? You have to bring it to the Beit HaMikdash and offer it as a korban. However, if it has a blemish from which it will not recover, it's called a mum, then you, the owner, are allowed to eat it. That's what the Torah says. Well, how do you determine whether it has a mum from which it will recover a blemish or it not recover? Got to be an expert. And there was a special smicha granted for that. Smicha had specialties, just like every other field has a specialty. You can have smicha just to paskin questions about kosher and non-kosher. That's the standard smicha. Then there is another type of smicha which allows you to be a judge in a court. That's called yodin. That's a special type of smicha. They still grant that today. Yodin yodin. And there was a third type of smicha called yatir b'chorot. You have the license to make a decision about a bechor. And in order to get that, you had to spend time on a farm and learn what defects an animal can recover from, because looking at the Gemara is going to get you nowhere.
I should just have the farmer as your advisor.
What? Because farmers don't know the halacha. They want you...
They know if an animal...
Okay, but we don't want to trust them. Maybe he's your friend, and he will lie through his nose just to enable you to eat. You'll make a deal with him. I'll give you 50% of the meat. Bezdin's never going to lie. Never suspect that Bezdin's going to cheat. Yes, what? Yeah, today we wouldn't say that anymore. That is correct. That is correct. We will never say that. So those are the five cases which are considered tam. A tam is the first three times, and for all of those cases, first three times, whether it's through kicking you, biting you, crushing you, leaning on you, or kicking you, or goring, you only pay 50% of the damage. Yes?
It has to be three times that it does the same activity?
That is correct. If it does twice goring with the horn, and once pushing you, he's not a muad yet. That is correct. We will learn later on how the patterns have to be established. Right? But does it have to be all during the day? Two during the day and one at night, that might not do it. All different types of patterns.
If you obviously have a very aggressive animal who's doing one, I mean, why don't they just get rid of the animal?
You don't have to get rid of him. Just watch him. Just watch him. Lock him up.
They're worth a lot of money.
Right? Don't forget. It's not only that.
They're pulling your thing.
Correct. The ox was the one that won, plowed your fields. Yeah. It was a very valuable animal. An ox plowed your fields. Right? You know, that's why the Torah always uses the expression, Leman Yonuach, Shorcha v'chamorcha. So that Shabbos, there is a halach of Shvitat Behema. Your animal's not allowed to do melacha for you on Shabbos. You can't. And the illustration which the Torah gives is your ox and your donkey. Not that it excludes anything else, but those are the most common animals used for work. Animal to plow and donkeys to carry packages for you. Carry weight. Carry all your burdens. So when you're not allowed to put a package on an animal, tell the animal, just walk with me and carry it to somebody's house. That's usur midda'oraita on Shabbos.
How do you know someone didn't go with the animal, though? I mean, this is just happens incidentally, but right. Like someone, and how would you know that someone didn't do something? Like
I wouldn't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I have to check what the halacha would be. But what happens if someone goaded him? Right. He waved his little red flag. I don't know. Don't know. So those are the five cases of tam. Now the Mishnah will enumerate five cases in which you are a mu'ad for the very first time that the damage happens. And there is nothing irregular about this. Number one. Hashein mu'edet le'echol et ha-ra'uy la. Shein means my animal, any animal, sees food in your lawn. Fruits, vegetables. And he typically eats tomatoes for lunch. So anything that an animal normally eats as part of its diet, you have to anticipate that what? That he's going to eat it. That's not something unusual, unexpected. So when your animal eats my tomatoes, you pay full damage. That's a mu'ad right away. But it's only when it eats ra'u'ila, that which it normally does. If it's not a carnivorous animal, doesn't eat meat, and suddenly decided to eat my hamburgers, you don't pay. That's tam. That's mishuneh. That's different. You'll only pay 50% of the damages. Why? Because it's not characteristic of an animal. So number one of the mu'adim, hashein mo'edet le'echol et hara'uila. Number two, haregel mu'edet lishbar b'derech hilucha. An animal is considered a mu'ad to break utensils while it's working, while it's walking. It just walks. Animals don't have the ability, apparently, to watch where they're going. So when they are damaging, but just by walking, you are owner or held accountable. Only if the damage takes place where? In your private property. In the victim's private property. In a public thoroughfare, who assumes the blame? The person. Who told you to leave your pots in the street? My animal has a right to walk in the street, and he can't be expected to see what's in front of him. But if my animal comes onto your property, then you can leave anything, you can be the biggest slob on the planet. You can leave anything you want. My responsibility is to make sure that my animal doesn't step on your pots. My responsibility is to make sure that my animal doesn't eat your tomatoes. You left your tomatoes on the middle of the public thoroughfare? That's my fault. Then it's your fault, rather. Who told you to leave your tomatoes in the middle of the public thoroughfare? So here it's talking about haregel mu'edet lishbar b'derech hilucha. A regel is considered a mu'ad to do damage as it is walking. No intention, there is no benefit, like a shame when it eats, just it's walking and it causes damage, you pay 100% of the damage. Number three, vishar hamu'ad. Shor hamu'ad. That's one of the previous five cases that was a pattern three times already. An animal kicked someone three times. On the fourth time, you pay full damage. An animal bit someone three times. On the fourth time, you pay full damage. An animal used its body to crush you against the wall and crack your ribs three times. On the fourth time, you pay full damages. That's the shor hamu'ad. An animal that normally does not exhibit that type of tendency, but it happened three times, it now is considered a mu'ad, and you have to pay full damages.
Is there a certain amount of time that this has to occur, like within a 12-month period? Or?
That's an interesting question. The Gemara will talk about that. Yes, there might be time restrictions, yes. And that each time, if it's so long apart, then it'll be, oh, it's just another unusual. That's correct. We'll get to that a little later, a lot later. But the Gemara does talk about it. That's a matter of your vote.
Are you going to take another vote?
Anytime you want. Anytime you want. I will not be in the room. You do so. I am serious. I'm not here to intimidate or to influence you. You can have a discussion one night, you know, and make a decision if you want to pursue with it, continue with this, or to go to something else. It's up to you. Case number 4. Vishor Hamazik Berishut HaNizak. This is, the Gemara is going to claim this is a minority opinion of Rabbi Tarfon. Namely, an ox that gores for the first time, but not in a public thoroughfare. An ox that goes into your property and gores your ox on your property, says Rabbi Tarfon, that pays Nezek Shalem right away. Only time that you pay the 50% is if it happens in a public thoroughfare. But in a private property, says the Mishnah, and the Gemara will go on, that's a minority opinion. We don't accept it. It's a minority opinion. For some reason, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi formulated in accordance with Rabbi Tarfon the minority opinion, because he thought it was right. Shor Hamazik Berushut HaNizak, that's a muad right away. The very first time, you pay full damages. That's 4. And number 5 is you and me. Vaha Adam. A human being that inflicts damage onto your property or to your person, to you personally, that pays full damages the very first time.
Well, of course.
What do you mean, of course?
Because you're a dumb animal.
That is correct. Okay, so it could be logical. That's true. It could be. It might be logical. It might be. That's correct. If you remember a couple of weeks ago, I pointed out that if not for the Torah teaching us that there is compensation required for damages, what conclusion might have I come to?
You don't have to pay for damages.
You don't have to pay for anything. You may not have to pay for anything. You may not have to pay. As strange as it sounds. Strange as it sounds.
How do you know that doesn't include children? It says Hadam.
Because there is a Mishnah 8 Prakim later, take a very long time to get there, and says, if I were to injure one of your grandchildren's property, I have to pay full damages. But if your grandchildren destroy my property, I could get paid nothing. It's called pigi'at hanra. The encounter is detrimental to you on both sides. The Gemara, 8th Perek, will deal with it. Why it is such. Why it's so. Doesn't seem like very fair. But the word fair is never to enter into our discussion.
So then why do you say Baruch Shepachayim Elchel Shazeh when it comes to Bar Mitzvah, if before Bar Mitzvah you weren't responsible for his
right.
Behavior? So why are we saying now there's Bar Mitzvah, I'm glad to be free
okay,
of that?
So that particular phrase is a very difficult phrase to understand. In what respect am I being punished by having my child do something? In what respect am I talking with
I always thought it was you're responsible for what they do.
But I'm not. I don't know. So let me ask you this. If my son, 12 years old, and 353 days, one day turns on the light on Shabbos, I'm responsible?
Yeah.
No, I'm...
No,
so here comes... That's correct.
That's
good. So here comes... two different perspectives. The common approach is that the reason why you say to Baruch Shepadayim Bar Mitzvah is that yes, in theory you are responsible for your children's misdeeds. You are. If my kid turns on the light, something should have happened to me. And maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu does do something to me because my child did something wrong. Maybe he does. I don't know. When he finally becomes Bar Mitzvah, I say, thank God, if he's going to do something wrong, he pays for it himself. I have nothing to do with it any longer. Baruch Shep Torani, thank the good Lord, who I have now been exempted, may onsho from the punishment that was saddled upon me, Thank God we'll be visited on my kid. Oh, what a wonderful bracha to make. In the Talmud, you're supposed to make that bracha according to many opinions with Shem Malchus. Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Haolam. In fact, Sfardim do. Shiptarani Mi'oncho Shalozah.
Well, there should be a distinction between Ben Adam and Makom and Adam
Chaveros. It might be, but according to the standard explanation, there isn't. The greatest difficulty with that explanation is, why don't you make that when a bat mitzvah comes? Why don't you make that bracha for a bat mitzvah? Even the Gemara couldn't think of that. That warp logic. The Gemara couldn't think of that.
But as opposed to saying that you should, you know, why aren't you punished when your young child does something? The truth is, you're always punished if your child does anything bad, even when they're past bar mitzvah.
No, I don't believe in it.
You're a bit emotionally, you are, because you raise your children a certain way, and it's still a, you know, emotionally, it never leaves you. Your children, you're never not responsible.
So number one, the question should be, why don't you make for a bat mitzvah? So I once explained an alternate explanation, that it has nothing to do with the fact that you are saddled with the burden of his punishment. First of all, as you pointed out, number one, a child is not obligated to observe any mitzvot. None. We try to train a child, yes. But if he's not interested, you can't force a child. Bet Din can never hold him accountable because he's low baro bat mitzvah. No doubt. And furthermore, I am a firm believer of the pasuk in Parshat Ki Tetzé, which says, Ish bechet o yumatu. Every person is held accountable only for their own transgressions. I don't ever believe that God punishes you or me because of what someone else did. I don't ever believe it. Even though it does say in the Torah, Pokeid avon avot, that God will remember the sin of the father, al biranim, al shilei shiva ribim, till four generations. Because I have another explanation for that one. And in fact, Rashi cites the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, which says, hey, these two things seem to be contradictory. One pasuk says that God will visit, you know, on the fourth generation. And the other one says, you die on your own ledger. Which one is it? So Rashi always quotes the Gemara's answer, Kan she'ochez ma'asei avoteim biyadeim, kan she'eino ochez. Meaning, if the child reforms and does not a transgressor, but he's good, he will never have the transgressions of the father visited upon him. So which pasuk is operative then? Ish bechet ol yimatu. But if the father eats tarfus, and the child eats tarfus, that's when the pasuk says, Pokeid avon avot al banim balbinim. That's the standard answer. It depends on what the child does. If he maintains the inappropriate ways, he will be punished for both, his and his parents, and his grandfather, and his great-grandfather, up to four generations. I don't believe that at all. I don't believe it. I really believe God cannot hold me accountable for what my great-grandfather did. I believe it's absurd to think that. So what does the pasuk mean? It means the following. I always use the same illustration because it always works. You have a situation with somebody engaged in what seems to be a neutral deed. A neutral deed. It's not an aveira. Okay? Here's the case. Somebody decided I hope I'm not stepping on anybody's toes, that yeshiva tuition is just much too expensive. Much too expensive. Okay. And you decide to pull your kids out of yeshiva and go to public school. And that kid will somehow try to maintain law and order based on the fact that you're going to try to, you know, run a tight household, and he's going to daven every day, he's going to do everything the Torah says. But his children are not even starting in yeshiva now. They're not even starting in yeshiva. They're going to go to Talmud Torah. Now let's go back a generation ago when many of us taught Talmud Torah. It was the biggest failure in the history of Jewish education, the Talmud Torah movement. Because kids hated it every minute they were there. All their friends are in Little League or a dance, and I got to sit there learning for my bar or bat mitzvah to read the Torah. My parents are on the golf course Saturday morning, and I got to go to junior congregation. And they developed such an animosity for it that the next generation didn't even send the Talmud Torah. That's why every conservative and reform synagogue, their Talmud Torahs don't exist anymore. Most of them. So many of them. They had emerged. Five shuls had emerged because they couldn't sustain it. Well, the next generation, four generations later, somebody married out of faith. Who are you going to blame? You going to blame this guy who married out of faith? It wasn't his fault. He never got a Jewish education. His parents never came to shul on Yom Kippur. What are you blaming him for? Who do you blame? The great-grandparent who took him out of yeshiva. Poked avon avot. HaKadosh Baruch Hu remembers our actions as it impacts up to four generations later. So who will be assessed, whatever is assessed? Not the child, but the grandparent. The grandparent every year is judged, even though he's in the Olam Hamas. HaKadosh Baruch Hu judges those who are alive and those who have passed away every year on Yom Kippur. And he looks what impact your actions have. And in the reverse, if your actions were beneficial, he rewards you for 500 generations, 500 times. Notzer Chesed, for how long? La'alafim, 2,000 generations. And I always use the same example. Joseph S. Gross, the single largest contributor to Jewish education in the history of the world. Joseph S. Gross was not particularly observant. He was traditional. That was a member of the Fifth Avenue Synagogue. Never gave a nickel to Jewish education. Never. Until his daughter got engaged to a Gentile. And he came to the Rav. The Rav told me the story many times. And he asked the Rav's wife to speak to his son. It was the daughter who married him. His daughter. Speak to the daughter. Maybe you convince her to break up the engagement and marry a Jew. And she succeeded. She convinced this guy, this daughter, his daughter, not to marry a Gentile. Mr. Gruss was so appreciative of the effort that he deposited his first $1 million with YU. The Rav developed a relationship with him, and every time there was a federation meeting that there was discussion about education, and Mr. Gross was on the New York Federation, the Rav went personally to the meeting to encourage Mr. Gross to continue giving. Personally. And I asked the Rav, why are you going to the meeting? Mr. Gross sent his limousine to take the Rav to the Federation in New York on 59th Street. I said, Mr. Gross told me, I was the shaman. Mr. Gross said, I'll come to the apartment. So the Rav said, he's in my apartment, I have to be a gentleman. I can't be too aggressive. I want to go onto his turf and tell him, you have to give another $1 million for Jewish education to Federation. On his turf, I can do it. I can't do it in my house, I've got to be a gentleman. So Mr. Gross has endowed a fund with the New York Federation in which every single Rebbe and every teacher of Jewish education in New York from Satmar to Solomon Schechter gets 1/3 of their health insurance paid by the Gross Fund, 1/3 of their health insurance paid by the school, that was the deal, and 1/3 comes out of the employee's pocket. That's an enormous thing. Then there is a life insurance policy and a pension policy that was set up all by Mr. Gross as long as you're in Jewish education. That's all you got to do. And then there is the Gross Covenant Award. He awards $10,000 to 10 teachers every year, master teachers. Got to be nominated, it's all process. $100,000 a year just to give a benefit for outstanding teachers. He is the single greatest contributor. Every year on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, every year, HaKadosh Baruch Hu opens up Mr. Gross's ledger and say, look at the thousands of people who are being educated because of what you did. Thousands. I went to Torah Semes Kamenetz in Borough Park. It was the biggest dump of a building on the planet, on 43rd Street in between 13th and 14th Avenue. Thank the good Lord, Mr. Gross's grandchild went to Torah Semes. Thank the good Lord. Because he came to the school and he said, my grandchildren is going to be educated in this dump. A year later, on 56th Street, there was the beautiful school. Mr. Gross built it himself. For the next 10 years, every single year at the Torah Semes dinner, Mr. Gross was the guest of honor. Every single year. And the Rav went to the dinner every single year. So did Rav Moshe Feinstein. So did Rav Shneur Cutler. Every single year. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe sent his top henchman. He didn't go himself. His top henchman. Because Mr. Gross gave to everybody. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu will look at Mr. Gross. All of those thousands of people that are in Torah Semes and Torah Tamima he built on Ocean Parkway and Lubavitch, everything. You get all the credit. That's HaKadosh Baruch Hu weighing a decision. Pokeid, not Avon Avot, but the mitzvah of the great-grandfather as it impacts 2,000 generations. For a negative impact, HaKadosh Baruch Hu only goes 4 generations. But I never believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does anything to you or me because of something my grandfather did. First benich shulda that my grandfather decided to eat tar for 6 months. My fault? That's his bechira. That's his choice. Let him pay for it. Not me. So here too, there is a sense of responsibility. A sense of responsibility that we expect people to take at this time. So there are 5 mu'adim. 5. The shein, animal that eats. The regel, the ox that went ahead and repeated any of the things 3 times. An ox that gores in a private domain, in your thing. And Adam Hamazik and Adam Harishon. We'll stop here and continue next Devar.